Members, 10:30 having arrived, I'm going to call the April 1st, 2022 meeting of the House Taxes Committee to order under Rules 10.01. And for those viewing, if you want all the materials that we have, simply go on the website to Minnesota House of Representatives, go to Committees and Divisions, then go to Taxes. And then on that home page off to the right, you'll find all of those materials. So with that, Ms. Griska, would you please call the roll?
Representative Marquardt.
Marquardt present.
Representative Marquardt present. Representative Lislegard.
Representative Lislegard present.
Representative Lislegard present. Representative David.
David's present.
Representative David's present. Representative Agbaje.
Present.
Representative Agbaje present. Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Carlson present. Representative Detmer.
Detmer present.
Representative Detmer present. Representative Garofalo.
Garofalo present.
Representative Garofalo present. Representative Gomez.
Gomez present.
Representative Gomez present. Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Herr present. Representative Hertas.
Hertas present.
Representative Hertas present. Representative Howard.
Howard present.
Representative Howard present. Representative McDonald. Representative Miller.
Miller present.
Representative Miller present. Representative Moran. Representative Mortensen. Representative Robbins. Representative Sandell.
Sandell present.
Representative Sandell present. Representative Schultz.
Schultz present.
Representative Schultz present. Representative Stevenson.
Present.
Representative Stevenson present. Representative Swazinski.
Present.
Representative Swazinski present. Representative Joachim.
Present.
Representative Joachim present. We have a quorum.
Very good. Thank you very much, Ms. Griska. Representative Chair Joachim, can I call on you to approve the minutes for March 31st, 2022?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move to approve the minutes of March 31st, 2022.
Members, any thoughts, changes, discussion? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. If you would temporarily unmute yourselves. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
The poll say nay. The motion does prevail. The March 31st, 2022 minutes are approved. Members, we have 9 bills today and 120 minutes to do that. That comes to about 13 minutes a bill. So members, a lot of these bills, if they make the final cut, we'll be able to talk about them later on also, but I hopefully we can move through these bills today, but I still want all the discussion that needs to occur and make sure everyone understands these bills. I know we have a number of testifiers. If I could ask the testifiers to hold your comments to about 2 minutes, 2 minutes on the testifying. All right, the first bill we have up is House File 4305. There he is, Representative Long. Welcome to the committee. Who would like to move the House File 4305?
So moved.
Chair Joachim moves House File 4305 for possible inclusion into the omnibus report. And we also have Representative Long. Is that okay if we move your A2 amendment at this time?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Chair Joachim, would you like to move that amendment?
I move the A2 amendment.
Thank you very much. Representative Long, is this to put it in the form you would like?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Members, I'd ask to take the vote then on the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Long, to your bill, House File 4305 as amended. And again, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Appreciate being before you. So this bill is a simple one. It would fix a current misinterpretation of what is a 1 megawatt solar project. So under our current tax approaches for solar projects, projects that have a co-location cap greater than 1 megawatt are taxed on their production, and projects that are smaller than 1 megawatt are assessed taxes based on their improvement to the land. So the question is, what is a 1 megawatt project? And this would help clarify what that is. Right now, the Public Utilities Commission, under a 2015 settlement agreement, has an interpretation of community solar gardens for 1 megawatts in terms of what is considered a co-located project, so a project where there is potentially an intention to get around the 1 megawatt cap with shared ownership or the like. So the Public Utilities Commission has an approach that they've used since 2015 on this, and all this bill would do is make that approach the approach that we're using for tax purposes. So it would make sure that we are being consistent with the Public Utilities Commission approach for what is 1 megawatt and ensuring that the practice used by revenue would use the same approach.
Thank you very much, Representative Long. And before we go to testifiers, the revenue estimate is for 2024, $50,000, and for 2025, $50,000. So let's go to our testifiers. And first up, we have Logan O'Grady. And then Daniel Willingham is on deck. So Logan O'Grady, are you? There you are.
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. For the record, my name is Logan O'Grady, Executive Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We aren't in this committee very often. It's great to be here. But for those unfamiliar with MNSEA, we're a 501c6 trade organization. We have about 140 member companies in the solar and energy storage industry. MNSEA's goal is really to promote pro-business, pro-economic development, and pro-job growth public policies that enable our member businesses to meet payroll, grow long-term in our communities, and hire more Minnesotans in family-sustaining jobs. Our work today is to promote a stable and consistently applied tax policy to our industry. As Representative Long mentioned, some of our members, who you'll hear from shortly, are receiving two different interpretations from two different state agencies. Obviously, this creates uncertainty for our developers and our financiers of our project, and it infringes and inhibits some of the deployment of solar because now our member companies have to go through a multi-step process to clarify what is and is not 1 megawatt. It should be noted that this is not a new exemption. It simply adjusts statute to reflect an existing exemption in statute. Overall, Mr. Chair and members, it's important for all of our industries, including the solar industry, to have consistently applied public policies so that we can plan for and invest in our communities. So with that, I'll remain for questions, but I know we have two of my members here today.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. O'Grady. Next, Daniel Willingham, and then David Schaefer. Mr. Willingham, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Willingham, and I'm tax counsel for Renewable Energy Alternatives based in Missouri. We are now investing in and developing community solar gardens in Minnesota, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Representative Long's HF 4305. Minnesota Solar Energy Production Tax Statute tax is established in Minnesota Statute 272.0295 and only applies to solar energy generating systems that are larger than 1 megawatt size, is stated very clearly in the statute. Solar energy generating systems that are 1 megawatt or smaller community solar gardens, or CSGs, are clearly exempt from the solar energy production tax statute, tax under subdivision 3B of that statute. The problem that exists with the solar energy production tax statute today is that its language is ambiguous as to how projects are determined to be co-located and therefore potentially larger than 1 megawatt size. As a result of the ambiguity, the Department of Revenue uses an interpretation of whether projects are co-located that is in clear conflict with the way the Department of Commerce interprets the statute. This results in DOR saying a group of projects should be subject to the solar energy production tax, while the DOC says they are not subject to it. These problems cause unnecessary and inefficient challenges for developers who are currently doing business in Minnesota and those who want to bring the benefits of clean energy and economic growth in the form of development, capital, and jobs to Minnesota. They also lead to a waste of government resources as DOR and DOC continue to spend time, effort, and money fighting each other with developers caught in the middle. I can assure you that supporting HF 4305 will attract developers from across the country to grow the state's clean energy infrastructure and create jobs in Minnesota. In the most conservative estimate, this legislation is essentially revenue neutral, as it does not eliminate any tax liability that currently exists, but merely clarifies the language regarding the solar energy production tax for all parties involved, including the DOR, DOC, and developers. Realistically, it will eliminate government waste we are seeing with the unclear language that's currently in place. In light of these circumstances, we ask for your support.
Mr. Willingham, would you please finish up?
In light of these circumstances, we ask for your support for HF 4305, and with that, I'll close. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. David Schaefer.
Chair Marquardt, members of the House Taxes Committee,
welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is David Schaefer. I'm Director of Policy and Government Affairs at Novel Energy Solutions. Novel Energy Solutions is a community solar developer. Today, I'm here to ask you all to support House File 4305. This bill clarifies that the Department of Revenue cannot tax solar arrays twice. Essentially, Minnesota Revenue is assessing a production tax on community solar projects that are 1 megawatt in size, which is contrary to the current law that allows for a production tax on projects greater than 1 megawatt. Revenue is doing this by applying a very expansive legal interpretation. The reasoning Revenue uses is that projects, when taken with other projects nearby, exceed 1 megawatt in total. They are, in the eyes of Revenue, co-located, and are thus, then, when taken together, bigger than 1 megawatt. Now, this is a strange conclusion, given that all, for the purpose of the program, the projects are deemed to be not co-located by default, by Xcel Energy, by the Department of Commerce, or by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. In order for a project to get built and to receive the value of solar rate, the community solar gardens must not be co-located. The PUC has determined and developed a robust array of what is essentially case law on what is and what are not impermissibly co-located projects. And developers have relied on this body of law to determine where and how to build to specifically not be co-located for the purposes of the program. So it's surprising that the Department of Revenue would assess a tax as if projects are co-located when other state agencies in the program host utility have already said directly or implicitly that the projects are not co-located. So today, the Department of Revenue is still seeking to assess the tax on garden owners in the face of the historical context set by the PUC. When fronted with the tax, owners can appeal the tax to the Department of Commerce. And to my knowledge, the Department of Commerce has yet to side against the solar owners, but this is a hassle. I know of some owners who are not aware of the historical context or did not know they could fight it, and they simply gave up and paid the tax. So I assume that that's the $50,000 impact there is developers just not knowing they can fight it. So it's really all upside for the tax collectors to try to assess it. So I think there's a logical question about whether the garden should pay tax in the first place. And the answer is that they already do. They're liable to pay taxes through property improvement, the same way as a commercial array is. CSGs are a way for residential subscribers and businesses to participate in solar, even if they rent, have bad roofs, or otherwise cannot put solar on their site. And you can do this for up to a megawatt in Xcel service territory. The tax system for community solar was designed to treat 1 megawatt gardens the same way, and we just want to have the same treatment for our gardens. So we are willing to pay taxes. We are not interested in paying taxes on the land improvement and on the revenue from the energy. And this bill ensures that revenue's practices will cease. With those reasons in mind, we ask for your support of House File 4305, and I stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schaefer. Before we go on, Representative McDonald, Representative Robbins are in attendance. Anyone else from the audience, virtual audience, would like to testify on House File 4305 as amended? If not, I do have an A3 amendment here. Representative Garofalo, are you going to offer that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Before we do that,
Representative Garofalo.
I thought I understood this, but maybe to the author or to the testifiers. So if this proposal were to go into effect, we're saying that there would be no taxes that would be reduced? Is that what I'm hearing from the testifiers, that the amount of taxes being paid would be the same?
Who, Representative Long or one of the testifiers? Yeah, Representative
I'm happy
Long.
To take that, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, I think Mr. Schaefer pointed out that so far Commerce has ruled in favor of all the solar developers that have appealed this, and so there's a disagreement between Revenue and Commerce. But I think that's correct. There would not, I think there was a $50,000 estimate that Chair Marquardt implied, but this is really not meant as a revenue raiser to have an impact on revenue. It's meant to provide clarity to the developers about what the standards are for solar gardens.
And Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, but I did not get, like, I used the House website as the reference point for our revenue notes, and I didn't see one out there today. Am I missing it on the House website?
I think one came late that I received to the email. Did everyone, Mr. Bannick, it was sent late this morning, I'm being informed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess, Mr. Chairman and members, before I offer my amendment, I'm just, I understand how the production tax works. I also understand how the community solar gardens are designed. I'm fascinated to learn that the Department of Commerce is overriding Department of Revenue decisions and rulings. I didn't know they could do that. so is there anyone who can provide some context under what statutory authorization Commerce is able to overturn taxation rulings from the Department of Revenue?
If anyone knows, they can, any House research, Mr. Schaefer, please keep it quick. I'm not going to get into the discussion of agency authorization here. So, Mr. Schaefer.
Chair Marquardt, Representative Garofalo, the production tax statute itself allows the appeal. And it was codified by court when a developer took revenue there.
Representative Garofalo.
Well, we learn something every day, Mr. Chairman, so thank
yes,
you.
Yes, we do.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move my amendment, the A3 amendment, and what it does is it says, just like when there are tax reductions that are taking place for businesses or preferences that are given to our utilities, what we do is we require them to pass on those savings to those who are paying the bills. They're not able to use this to pad their bottom line or give big bonuses to high-flying corporate executives and profiteers. We say you got to help out the ratepayers. That's all my amendment does. It says these savings have to be passed on to the people who are actually paying the bills in these programs, and they can't be used to pad the bottom line. So that's my amendment. I would move that amendment and ask for member support.
Thank you very much. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd ask that members oppose Representative Garofalo's amendment. This amendment would do more than Representative Garofalo says. It would actually essentially double tax the companies that we're talking about, because they would have to pass on the cost of the production tax credit, which is what we're trying to clarify here. So I think if you don't want to raise taxes on businesses, then I'd ask you to vote against Representative Garofalo's amendment.
Representative Garofalo is the author of the A3 amendment. Last word.
Yeah, well, when we provide a tax preference for our incumbent utilities, we pass those savings on to the customers. We don't let businesses gain it as an additional revenue stream. That's the same thing that this amendment would do.
Thank you very much. The chair is going to call for a vote on the A3 amendment, so everyone just unmute yourselves right now. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed of the A3 amendment, please say nay.
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 The motion does not prevail. The A3 amendment is not adopted. Any other member questions or comments? Representative Long to House File 4305 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I ask for the committee support.
Thank you very much, Representative Long and testifiers. The chair will lay over House File 4305 as amended. Next bill up is House File 4640, Representative Hewitt. Before we do anything, Representative Hewitt. There he is. Welcome to the committee. Would someone care to move House File 4640?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Herr moves House File 4640 for possible inclusion into the House Tax Omnibus Bill. Representative Hewitt, welcome to the Tax Committee. Tell us what House File 4640 does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, distinctive tax members. This is definitely the committee to be in front of, and it's quite an honor. This bill basically was brought to me by the State Fair. Like many of you, I'm a big fan of the fair, and they've been having, they've definitely had an attendance issue in the last couple of years through no fault of their own. I wasn't aware that the fair didn't get any money from the state up until now. They basically are self-supported. The other thing that I learned is they don't bond through the state. They bond on their own, so they have a debt service they got to keep up. I know in the last couple of years, this was kind of an idea that this committee and the state has allowed the county fairs to retain their sales tax to help with their maintenance of their buildings. This bill would allow the state fair to retain their sales tax that they generate on sales of tickets for 2 years from the fair 2022 to 2023. The legislation further requires that the retained sales tax would be used for maintenance of the fair facilities. Basically, today with me, I have the general manager of the fair, Jerry Hammer, who is here to testify on this and answer any of our questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Hewitt. Mr. Hammer, welcome to the committee. If you would please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thanks very much. And good morning, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Hammer. I'm the general manager of the State Fair. Prior to 2002, the fair actually was allowed to retain sales tax on tickets that were sold here, provided that it was used for maintenance and improvements. The fairgrounds are 322 acres with a lot of facilities. They're defined by law as state property in the care, custody, and control of the State Agricultural Society, which is the governing body of the fair. It was founded in 1854, and it's the same institution today. It's actually older than the state. In 2002, there was a budget deficit, and the state fair lost her sales tax exemption at that time. And we thought about seeking to reinstate that and decided not to. We were doing okay without it. And actually, in the last two decades, we've invested nearly $200 million in state fairgrounds, which are state property. So we decided not to seek the change, but then COVID blew everything up. Now, as background, the fair doesn't get any funding from the state, city, county, or anybody. We're entirely self-supported by revenue generated. About 96% of our operating revenue comes from the fair itself. It's one of the largest events in the world. In 2019, we had people from all 50 states plus 33 nations around the globe. So it's a big event. When that goes away, as it did in 2020 when we're canceled, we're completely dependent on revenue generated from the fair. And most of that, except for a few percent of our operating revenue, comes from the fair itself. The balance is from about 200 non-fair events that we do at the fair. And last year, after being shut down in 2020, many people were affected by that. And when you're in the business of bringing people together, which is what the fair is all about, and you can't, it's devastating, and it was really brutal. So last year, you remember, especially May and June, things are looking good. July, they're looking even better. And then the Delta variant hit, so not so fast. So we worked very closely with our friends at the State Health Department, following CDC guidelines to present a safe event, which we did. Nevertheless, attendance was off about a third last year. So in a typical year, the fair generates between 55 and 60 million in operating revenue and a net operating gain of about 10% of that, all of which is reinvested in the fair. The better the fair, the more work we're able to do to the fairgrounds, the better event we're able to produce. And all that revenue, it also provides a huge economic impact in the Twin Cities. It's, every year Super Bowl side. So anyway, despite being shut down in 2020 and a soft year last year, we worked hard to keep our operation intact, our staff intact, and we did. But to do that, we basically spent all our reserves. We shut down our maintenance and improvements programs, and it's essential to keep those going.
Mr. Hammer, would you finish up here shortly?
I'm very sorry. Yeah. Okay. Well, in sum, yeah.
This is good information to know, but we are on a really tight
schedule. I got it. And I apologize, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. COVID basically changed everything for us. We're now in a position where we could use a little help for a couple of years. And thank you very much for your consideration. And
thank you so much. And thanks for the work you do with the fair there. So anyone else that would care to testify on House File 4640? If not, members, questions, thoughts? So this would be for 2 years. Is that correct, Representative Hewitt? And Representative
Hewitt? Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. The revenue estimate is for 2023, $3 million, and for 2024, $3.3 million. All right, seeing and no further questions, Representative Hewitt, closing thoughts.
Once again, committee and Mr. Chair, thank you for your consideration and possibly putting this in your big bill, and I appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Representative Hewitt, thank you very much. The chair will lay over House File 4640. Next bill is House File 4590. Representative Leslegard.
Bill moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Leslegard moves House File 4590 for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill. Representative Leslegard, tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you also last year for the support regarding Minnesota film and TV tax credit. But the TV and film projects don't always begin and end in the same calendar year. And last year's language inadvertently required projects to only get credits during the calendar year. So this is a technical change. The current language requires that a minimum of $1 million expenditure occur within a taxable year. This amendment changes that requirement to a 12-month period. And I believe I have one testifier that can speak to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Leslegard. And the revenue estimate shows no cost to House File 4590. So we have Melody Bahan. You'll correct me if you will.
Bahan.
All right. Very good. Ms. Bahan, please introduce yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Markward and members of the committee. Good morning. I'm Melody Bahan. I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Film and TV. Minnesota Film and TV is the 501c3 organization that serves as our state's film commission. Thank you for allowing me to testify in support of this amendment. What happened after, and thank you for supporting the tax credit last session, film and TV projects, as Representative Leslegard, do not always begin and end in the same calendar year, and this amendment will just correct that. Requiring a $1 million minimum spend within a single taxable year effectively shuts out all projects that want to begin production at the end of a year and carry over into the following year. And that's a lot of projects that are attracted to Minnesota because of our beautiful winter weather. So this doesn't change the minimum expenditure. What we're hoping is to not lose the momentum that we already have in this year. We have had right now, because we didn't have any projects apply in 2021 because of this language. So the applications began in 2022, and we have currently three projects coming in with an expected expenditure of more than $10 million just on these three projects. And of that 10 million, more than 6 million of that is in wages for Minnesota workers. So we don't want to lose that momentum. We want to be able to keep these projects coming and this brand new money coming into the state. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bayen. Do I hear any questions or comments? I don't see any from members. Anyone else would like to testify on House File 4590? If not, Representative Leslegard, final thoughts?
Good bill. Hope you support it. Thank you.
The chair will lay over House File 4590. Representative Leslegard, you now, next up is House File 4591. Would you care to move your bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Leslegard moves House File 4591. And to be laid over for possible inclusion, there is an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move that, Representative Leslegard?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
No worries.
Very good. Representative Leslegard moves A1 amendment. Is this just to get it in the order in which you would like?
Yes, it's just to match up with the Senate, in 2023.
Very good. So members, I'm going to call for the vote on the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Leslegard, the House File 4591 as amended.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and committee members. As a part of the rural electrification effort in 1939, the Minnesota legislature enacted a law that exempted electric cooperative distributive lines and things attached to them, to those lines in unincorporated areas from personal property taxes. Instead, cooperatives are required to pay a fee based on the number of co-op members the electric co-op serves, $10 per 100 members. This bill clarifies that the law excludes attachments to the rural electric cooperative distributive lines in an unincorporated area from personal property taxes. This law was enacted to avoid imposing an undue tax burden on nonprofit electric cooperatives and their efforts to bring essential service of electricity to rural Minnesota on par to serve with others. So far, at least two other states, nonprofit electric cooperatives have been assessed property tax on this infrastructure by the Department of Revenue. Those two cooperatives are here to speak with us today.
Thank you very much, Representative Leslegard. And the revenue estimate, just only in 2025, $520,000. So 2025, $520,000 in the revenue estimate. So it looks like we have Robin Doge and Mike Henke. And so Robin Doge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can you hear me?
Can you hear me, Mr. Chair? To the committee. All right. And please introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Just a quick shout out to Representative Detmer. Coach Detmer is a former student. Good to see you online today. So I'm going to be brief. Again, my name is Robin Dagey. I'm the CEO at Stearns Electric Association. Our headquarters are in Melrose, Minnesota, and we provide electricity to rural members in Stearns and surrounding areas. We're part of a larger co-op family. I think in Minnesota, there's about 1.7 million members served by rural electrics in Minnesota. I'm here today in support of Representative Leslegard's House File 4591 and the language clarification that it includes. So I'm going to be brief. I'll just tell you our Stearns Electric story when it comes to appurtenances and attachments. Last July, we received our valuation notice from the department. And to our surprise, our apportionable market value at Stearns Electric went from $12.8 million to $18.6 million, increase of about $5.8 million. We thought, certainly this must be a mistake. It's the first time we've ever seen a jump like this in our property tax. So essentially, our property taxes went from $560,000 per year to $725,000 per year. As you can see, a significant increase. We contacted the department. We had an appeal hearing that was not successful for Stearns Electric. We contested the hearing. We received our final determination in September. And in December, we filed notice with the Minnesota Tax Court to kind of continue our contesting this new assessment. So that's where we're at today. And I'll just close with this. So, you know, rural co-ops are not-for-profit organizations. Our business model is to break even every year. this additional increase. It's something that we haven't paid in over 80 years. As Representative Listegard said, we pay a tax in lieu of this property tax, and we've done that for over 80 years. As far as the tax shift or determination on this, this is the first year Stearns Electric and you'll hear from Mike Hinkey, People's Electric, have been taxed on our meters and AMR equipment. So we don't have any history here. There won't be any tax shift since it's a first time event. So in closing, I just want to say we would appreciate your support for House File 4591 on behalf of the co-ops in Minnesota. If you have any questions, I'm free to take those, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Dagey. I do have a question. Can you tell us anything about Representative Detmer that would be good for the committee to know? That? And what did you teach?
No secrets.
Yeah, so Representative Detmer, he was a wrestling coach at Forest Lake High School. He was a Phi Ed coach, health coach. Matter of fact, I learned about the birds and the bees from Coach Detmer. He taught that part of our health class in high school. Well, I shouldn't say just from Coach Detmer, but anyway, yeah, he was a great role model for us at Forest Lake High School.
That's great to hear. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
What class graduation?
Excuse me?
What class did you graduate?
Oh, way back when in 1980.
Class of?
Yeah, 1980.
1980, so, Representative.
So, Bob, Detmer. You know my dad probably better than me, Joseph. He worked at the school district as well.
That's a good year.
Thank you very much.
A good year.
Representative Moran is also here in attendance. Mr. Hanke, please introduce yourself.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Hanke. I'm president and CEO of People's Energy Cooperative. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. People's Energy Cooperative is a not-for-profit rural electric distribution cooperative serving about 20,000 members in rural areas and small towns in southeastern Minnesota surrounding Rochester. We don't serve the city of Rochester itself. Our service territory covers about 1,000 square miles in parts of six counties. We serve our members with 29 substations, 3,000 miles of power line, and 68 employees. We're a small company in nearly all respects. As my colleague Robin said, keep in mind that our objective as member-owned not-for-profit electric cooperatives is to bring affordable electricity to rural Minnesota. We're not there to make a profit. We only collect enough margin to cash flow our operation, and then we return any excess margins, also called equity, to our members in the form of capital credits. In 2020, we had a similar experience to Stearns Electric, as Robin alluded to. The Department of Revenue included our meters in our rural areas as taxable property for the first time ever in 80 years. The resulting tax was $200,000 to our cooperative. So to put that $200,000 additional tax in perspective, we historically pay about $750,000 annually in property taxes. That's both personal property and real property. This $200,000 is a 27% increase in 1 year. And for a small business like ours, that is very huge. As a not-for-profit, our primary goal is to keep electric rates low as we can for our members. Affordable rates are a huge deal for us, and we take a lot of pride in delivering reliable service affordably. Right now, our residential rates are comparable to the rates of urban investor-owned utilities like Xcel. Even though Xcel has greater economies of scale and also their members per mile of line is more than us. In our industry, we're constantly balancing rates and reliability. We did not raise our rates to members to cover this 27% increase in our property tax bill. I just couldn't do that to our members. So instead, I cut $200,000 from our budget by reducing our second largest expense, which is the cost of maintaining our electric lines. This could very, very well have a direct effect on our members' electric reliability. Current law in section 273.41 exempts cooperative distribution lines in unincorporated areas, along with the attachments and appurtenances to those lines from personal property tax. I find it bewildering that meters, which are attached to rural cooperative distribution lines are suddenly taxable when they've been exempt from personal property taxes for 80 years. The bill before you today, HF 4591, simply clarifies and reaffirms that attachments, including meters and streetlights, are exempt from personal property taxes under Minnesota statutes, consistent with longstanding practice. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for the opportunity to address you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Henke. So is there anyone else that would like to testify on House File 4591 as amended? If not, Chair Davids.
Thank you, Chair Markport. I hope in an omnibus tax bill we can get the Lizzo Guard bill in the omnibus bill. The department's off the rails on this one. I mean, just out of the blue, they raise the prices on our local not-for-profit cooperatives, and eventually that's going to have to be passed on to every member. It's extremely regressive. The department made a mistake here. I'd like them just to rescind it. If not, we will help them rescind it. We will help them understand what the law says. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Anyone else have any comments, thoughts? If not, Representative Westlegard, final comments on House File 4591 as amended.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. How can we go wrong? We learned about the birds and the bees and Representative Detmer and then low rates and reliability. This is just a good bill. I ask everybody to support it.
Thank you very much, Representative Westlegard. Thank you, testifiers. The chair will lay over House File 4591 as amended. With that, members, I'm going to turn the virtual gavel over to Chair Joachim for the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next item on the agenda is House File 4678. Chair Markwart, would you like to move your bill to be laid over for possible inclusion in the tax omnibus bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will lay over House File 4678. And so this is a bill that actually first went into effect in 2006. And I have to say that Representative Tom Rukavina was the one who first carried this. And what it says is that the Minnesota State High School League, on their state tournaments, on the sales taxes, they are able to keep those, rather than send it into the state, they can send that to the High School League Foundation. And it comes to, in 2019, it was about $875,000 a year. And what they do with this sales tax dollars for their state tournaments is they put it in this foundation. About half of it goes to pay student fees. So if a student can't pay student fees, it goes out to schools and they can help pay for that. It also goes for coaches' education, professional development, city bus passes or transportation to get kids to their extracurricular activities. So it's always had a sunset. And like I said, it went into law in 2006. And actually for a few years, the sunset went out and then we didn't have a tax bill. So they actually couldn't do this for a couple years. The current sunset is July 1st of 2027. Excuse me. This would extend that to July 1st of 2030. I mean, maybe we should just do away with this rather than the sunsets, but in the spirit of the tax expenditure review, this would increase it to 8 years from 8 years from today to 2030. So members, that's the bill. There's no cost in this budget window because the sunset would go until 2030. So that's the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, are there any questions for Chair Markwart? Seeing none, Chair Markwart, final word.
No, thank you, members. And it's something we've been doing and just would extend it a few more years before we'd have to come back. And maybe ultimately we just make this permanent. But thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. With that, Chair lays over House File 4678 for possible inclusion in the tax omnibus bill. And now I will hand the virtual gavel back to Chair Markwart.
Thank you so much, Chair Joachim. The next bill on the agenda is House File 4446. Representative Schultz. Representative, there, welcome to your committee, Representative Schultz. Would you like to move the bill?
I would like to move the bill. Thank you, Chair Marquardt.
All right, House File 4446 is moved for possible inclusion into the House Omnibus Tax Bill. Representative Schultz, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt and members. House File 4446 establishes a workforce incentive fund. It provides grants for behavioral health, housing, disability, and home and community-based older adult providers. It additionally exempts grant payments from state taxes and from being considered income for the purposes of the property tax refund program. These grants will be used for retention and incentive payments and for education, transportation, and childcare costs for eligible workers. To be eligible, a worker must earn $30 or less per hour and have worked in the profession for at least 6 months. And an eligible worker may receive up to $5,000 per year. So this bill is just part of a very large package that we're putting together in Health and Human Services to address our healthcare workforce shortage, which is a priority for us. And it has to come to taxes because of that tax provision. So I'm open for questions, but I also do have some testifiers, Chair Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Representative Schultz. I have Christy Grammi and Marin Holden, and I certainly don't have confidence that I have that name pronounced correctly. So Christy Grammi, please introduce yourself. Give us your correct pronunciation and begin with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Grammi, and I'm with the Department of Human Services, where I'm the Legislative Director for the Community Supports Administration. And I'll just note that my family says that the E in the letter of my last name may used to have had an accent aigu over it. So it's fine to do the French pronunciation as well. I'm totally fine with that. But
so would you please pronounce your last name again one more time?
It's Grammi.
Grammi, just Grammi. Okay, very good. Yes. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Chair, members, well, I just first of all want to start off by thanking Representative Schultz for bringing this bill forward. In Minnesota, we're seeing record vacancies in health and human service economic sectors, particularly in the human service frontline professions, which are largely financed by public programs. And so we're seeing, you know, pretty severe workforce shortages with around 40,000 vacancies in the last quarter of 2021. And those vacancies coupled with the demographic shifts in the labor market and people needing access to care is really creating some significant situations where people are not being able to access, you know, basic care to meet their needs in their homes and in their communities. So Chair Schultz, as well as the governor, are approaching this crisis using a multi-pronged approach, as Chair Schultz mentioned, including some long-term structural changes to reimbursement rates and administrative reforms, as well as the bill before you, House File 4446, which authorizes some grant funds that would be used for retention and incentive and bonus payments for frontline workers. So for over 6 years in Minnesota, we've been considered a federally designated mental health professional shortage area, except for some pockets in the Twin Cities and in the southeastern region of the state. We also have a severe shortage of professionals who can treat substance use disorders. So our licensed alcohol and drug counselors we're in severe shortage of those professionals as well. When it comes to the direct support workforce or workers that support largely people with disabilities and older adults, we're seeing some really alarming trends as well. The Department of Employment and Economic Development's job vacancy surveys for the fourth quarter in 2019 and the second quarter in 2020 reported that personal care aid positions had the highest number of vacancies of any occupation statewide. And so this is a really important bill. We're very supportive of this measure and happy to answer any questions. Just a couple of notes of why it's important that this particular income, when it goes to individual workers, is not included for tax purposes. So the majority of this workforce is part-time. About 52% of direct support professionals are working part-time and 48% full-time. The median starting wage for this workforce is $14.32 an hour. So these are workers that are making very low wages, really struggling to put food on the table and pay their rent. So we're not wanting to penalize them with these extra payments. We're wanting to incentivize them to stay in these jobs. And I would just note lastly that about 53% of these workers are offered health insurance by their employer. So I'm happy to turn it over to our next testifier and answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Grum. Next, Maren Holden. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and begin your testimony.
And you did get my name correct. My name is Maren Holden, and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. The Minnesota Disability Law Center is Minnesota's federally designated protection and advocacy organization, and we provide free legal services to kids and adults who have disabilities across the state. I'm also the policy co-chair of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, which is a broad-based coalition of individuals, advocacy organizations, and providers working on disability policy issues. I'm going to speak specifically to the workforce shortage in disability services, which is absolutely the most pressing challenge that we hear about for people with disabilities across the state right now. Direct support is really important work. People who have disabilities rely on this workforce to help them live and work where they choose. And yet, as Ms. Grom mentioned, the pay is quite low, especially relative to other jobs. Some direct support professionals make less than $15 an hour, and others don't make much more than that. In the current workforce climate, it is really easy for these folks to find higher paying work elsewhere to help them make ends meet and pay for things like childcare. This has left thousands of direct support jobs unfilled across the state and has had a devastating impact on people with disabilities. We hear so many stories of people who worked for decades to build a life in their own apartment, their own home, only to have to give it up and move to a congregate setting just this winter. Of people who have been happy in their group home for decades, only for it to close on short notice for lack of staff and leave their family scrambling to find something else, usually a less community-based option. Many of us feel like we're watching the progress and promise of inclusion and integration for people who have disabilities literally collapse before our eyes. This is one of the tallest orders we see facing the legislature this session, how to help our state deal with this workforce collapse. And it's not limited to disability services. As you heard from Ms. Grom, human services programs across the board are facing similar shortages. We need both immediate and long-term solutions. In the immediate term, what is absolutely pressing is to keep the workers who are still doing this work. And House File 4446 offers a way for employers and providers in a range of human services areas to strategically use grants to retain as many workers as they can. It provides the kind of immediate relief that we've been calling for and ensures that these payments are excluded from state and property taxes. These grants will give providers the tools they need to figure out what would help their workers stay in this profession, whether it's one-time bonuses, higher education opportunities, or childcare. People who do this work love this work and they want to do it, but they can't continue justifying it if they can't pay their bills, can't pay for childcare, or want to pursue higher education. House File 4446 would provide a huge help to stop this workforce collapse and ensure folks across the state get the support they need. Thank you so much for your consideration and your time today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Holden. Anyone else would care to testify on House File 4446? And before we go to members, the revenue estimate has no cost. This grant would be a subtraction on both the income tax for income tax purposes and also would not be included as income on property tax refunds. So with that, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Schultz. I heard this bill yesterday in HHS as part of the omnibus walkthrough and had a question, but you had to leave, so I wasn't able to ask you. So on line 1.16 of this version, it talks about the eligible employer means a nonprofit organization. And so I had a call from a constituent yesterday morning who was very concerned that for-profit providers are not going to be able to participate in that because they are equally struggling with the workforce challenges that have been, you know, very well outlined here. And their residents are equally in need of good care and that their facilities stay open. So I just wondered why you've excluded for-profit and then I'll have a follow-up. Thank you.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. And I would have mentioned this yesterday, but I was in conference committee for the reinsurance bill, so I apologize that I was not in committee to answer this question or to discuss this. But this was language we got from the we worked with the agency on, and this was a grant program. And I am aware that we have a lot of for-profit group homes that are struggling. So I think we allocated $50 million to this initiative. And so we are hoping to allocate more with given our budget target and definitely want to open it up to for-profit and nonprofit. So we'll make that change in our omnibus. So we're not bringing an amendment forward, but when you'll see the omnibus bill rolled out, we are hoping to make that change because I understand that it's a big problem. So, but thank you for asking the question here in taxes. And I'm sure people in taxes probably don't want us to discuss HHS issues, but it is good that I was able to say that. So sorry, Chair Marquardt.
No, thank you.
I just appreciate the opportunity.
Representative Robbins, you bet.
Sorry, I appreciate Robbins. It. Thank you.
Okay, Chair Joaquim.
I just wanted to say thank you because I hear about this from the organizations in my community and upward of 30% of employment gaps. So greatly appreciate the work and glad we could make it as non-income on the other end too. So thanks.
Thank you very much. Any other members? Comments? House File 4446. If not, Representative Schultz, any closing thoughts?
Well, thank you for taking time to hear this section of a very large bill to address healthcare workforce issues. I'm very thankful for all of our members in HHS and a strong team that we're working on this together and looking forward to bringing that bill forward. I hope our omnibus bill doesn't need to come to taxes, so maybe you can make that happen, Chair Marquardt. If not, I might see you again on that bill. So anyway, thanks, members. Hope you can support this bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Schultz. The chair will lay over House File 4446. Thank you. Next is House File 4318. Representative Egbaje, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to make a motion for 4318?
Yes, I so move that this bill be considered for consideration.
Very good. Representative Egbaje, moves House File 4318 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Please proceed.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So I'm presenting House File 4318. This is a bill to address some discrepancies in the tax code related to single member LLCs. These are LLCs with only one owner. Limited liability companies are pretty flexible entities that can be taxed as partnerships or corporations. And in the case of single member LLCs, taxes are dealt with through their owner's income tax return. Single-member LLCs are considered disregarded entities under the federal code and are eligible for some tax benefits similar to other LLCs. But in Minnesota, while other LLCs have access to those same benefits, single-member LLCs are inexplicably excluded. This gap creates a trap for unwary single-member LLC owners who assume that all types of LLCs will be treated the same under both the federal and state tax codes. This bill would establish basic fairness and consistency to help single member LLC owners who are often sole proprietors. It does this in two ways. It allows for single member LLCs to claim credit for taxes it has paid in other states by allowing a sale of tangible goods between the sole proprietor and the disregarded LLC to qualify for a sales tax exemption. So I'd like to acknowledge the tax law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association for this bill to address this issue, and to provide more details and insight is Dan Kidney, an attorney and CPA who's here to testify.
Thank you very much, Representative Egbaje. And we will first go to the revenue note for House File 4318 in 2023. It's $900,000 in 24, $950,000 and in 25, $1.1 million. And I see we have one testifier on the list, Dan Kidney. Are you here?
There we go.
There you are. There Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt, Representative Baje, and members of the committee. My name is Dan Kidney. I'm a director at Whipley, and I'm here to represent the tax law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, but I want to note that the Minnesota CPA Society also supports this bill. So as Representative Agbaje explained, this bill is about Minnesota tax fairness for business, often small business, who operate using a single member LLC, which is simply an LLC with one owner. Sole proprietors like them because they don't require a separate tax return and their profit is reported right on the owner's Form 1040. But strangely enough, Minnesota tax law does not provide the same benefits to single member LLCs and their owners that they do to LLCs with more than one owner. So to illustrate, I want to give an example of Chris, who is a Twin Cities resident who wants to launch a business that buys rental real estate and forms it as a single member LLC. So first I want to talk about sales tax, how that applies when Chris first sets up the business. He has $10,000 worth of office equipment, contributes to the LLC in exchange for $10,000 worth of LLC interest. If the LLC had more than one member, there would be no sales tax when he does that because of a current exemption that applies to a reorganization. But under current law, transfers between a single member LLC and their sole owner don't qualify. So Chris may effectively have to pay roughly $700 of Minnesota sales tax by collecting it from his own LLC. And because that wouldn't apply if there was more than one member of this LLC, that's unfair. Now here's how Minnesota personal income tax applies as the business grows. So Chris's LLC buys some property in the Twin Cities, pays Form 1040 tax on the Minnesota income to the IRS and to Minnesota. Then Chris wants to expand to other states, and as a Minnesota resident, he knows that Minnesota will tax him on rent in other states as well as in Minnesota, but he'll get a credit on his Minnesota 1040 for income tax he pays to another state. Then he finds a great property in Tennessee, but finds out that Tennessee doesn't have a personal income tax. Instead, they have a business income tax on pretty much every legal entity, including all kinds of LLCs. If the LLC had more than one member, the Tennessee income tax that he would owe would be creditable in Minnesota. But because there is a one-owner LLC, he still pays Tennessee, but Minnesota won't give a credit, making him pay state income tax twice on the same income. And to double tax Chris on this just because he uses a single-member LLC is unfair. So hopefully that's a simple example. I'm open to any questions.
Mr. Kidney, thank you so much. You learn something every day. So appreciate that. Anyone else would like to testify in House File 4318? If not, I'll go Representative Hertaus.
Good morning, members. Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Kidney, for that very concise and clear explanation of some ambiguities that do exist in Minnesota law. Members, the other day I mentioned that we have a large number of small businesses in Minnesota. I don't have the data right in front of me, but I recall that roughly 47% of all employees in Minnesota are employed by small businesses. And what we are talking about here are single owner or single employee or single operators under one organized entity. And I also remember that of that 47%, that was like 1.2 million jobs in Minnesota. And it quickly went down in terms of the numbers, like three-fourths of the folks worked for entities under 20 employees, and then even fewer in 10 or less employees. But what was quite surprising is there's somewhere between 250 and 300,000 of these single LLC or single operator small businesses. So thank you for bringing this forward to the legislature and trying to correct this. And I would encourage everybody to support this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Anyone, any other members' comments or questions? Seeing none, Representative Igbaje, it sounds like you've got a popular bill here. Thanks for bringing this forward. Any closing thoughts that you have?
No, just hope for the committee support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The chair will lay over House File 4318. Representative Igbaje, you are next with House File 4689. Would you like to move that bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
And there is an A1 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes. So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bajay moves the A1 amendment. And would you like to go over the amendment or just make it part of when you go over the bill? Or how?
Yeah,
would you like
I'll make it part of going over the bill.
All right. Very good. So members, to get the bill in the shape the author would like, I'd ask to call a vote on the A1 amendment. Members, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, please say nay. The motion does prevail. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Igbaje, to House File 4689 as amended.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for indulging me in the second bill. So for you today is House File 4689 as amended. The purpose of this bill is to provide needed assistance to small businesses across the state. We know that COVID had a major effect on small businesses and some barely survived. Of the ones that did, they credit the support of federal and state government to keep them stabilized so they could continue to pay their staff. Yet outside of COVID relief, we know that small businesses have often struggled, especially those based in low income and or underinvested communities. Such small businesses are not able to readily access many of the investment tax benefits either because of their size or limited interest from outside investors. Yet these companies are the lifeblood of so many neighborhoods. The purpose of this bill is to ensure that small businesses also have a fair shot at success similar to our large corporations. So I'll walk through the bill as it's amended. The first section of the bill provides for subtraction and defines the corporations eligible for such a subtraction from the assistance provided in this bill. The second section of the bill describes the type of aid and qualifying businesses that for such aid. This section provides $50 million in assistance through the counties to their local small businesses. These businesses are ones that are based and working in underserved or underinvested communities. The funds in this section will be available for businesses to pay people living wages, continue the maintenance and upkeep of commercial buildings, support down payment assistance for businesses who want to own their own spaces, and support high costs of rent for commercial spaces. All things that we know that are crucial for small businesses to survive. We're also asking counties to prioritize the needs of such communities when they're administering this business aid. The $50 million allocation can also be used to support businesses that opened in 2020 and were immediately affected by the pandemic, but were ineligible for many of the support programs because they had no 2019 income for comparison. We want to ensure that these businesses who have survived in this turbulent environment are not left behind. Finally, the allocation may be used to support venues such as theaters, music halls, and more that had to close in the face of COVID-19 to keep people safe. Arts are important to our communities, and many of these places are now only starting to light up their stages again, and we want to ensure that they get the help they need to stay open in a safe manner. The bill also additionally allocates $25 million for rental assistance. Housing stability is paramount for Minnesotans. The pandemic, as many of us know, brought that instability into stark relief. We did have various forms of aid and assistance to support renters and landlords to help pay their bills, but as we've seen, there's still more gaps to fill. The purpose of this assistance is to support counties who did very well in administering rental assistance to ensure that landlords got paid and renters could stay in their homes. We hope that this additional infusion of support will provide housing stability for Minnesotans in need. Today, I have three testifiers who will speak about the importance of the business aid to their communities, and I will turn it over to them now, Chairman.
Thank you very much. So we have Crystal Porter, and then KB Brown is on deck. So I see Crystal Porter. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Yes, my name is Crystal Porter, and I'm a resident and business owner in and I have with friends of business owners in North Minneapolis. I'm also the head gymnastics coach for North Henry and Edison High Schools. And every summer, I work hard to make sure that my gymnasts secure a summer job, which is nearly impossible in my community, that only has two places to sit down and eat, zero movie theaters, and one coffee shop between Mississippi River on the east, Golden Valley on the west, Olson Highway on the south, and Brooklyn Center on the north end. The unemployment rate for working adults in my community is nearly 33%, and over 53% of residents in my community are living in poverty. On our most major commercial corridor, aka West Broadway Avenue, we have some blocks that are entirely boarded up C1 and C2 properties, which is a huge loss in potential commercial property tax collection and an even bigger missed opportunity for the job opportunities that could be available for a community with the lowest area median income and highest unemployment rate in the city. The businesses that are there are struggling, and they already have the odds stacked against them by not being able to secure a business loan due to the inability to pass feasibility studies and by not having familial wealth to borrow from. These businesses are usually run by scraping the bottom of the barrel every day to keep the doors open. And after COVID-19 and civil unrest in our community, it is even it's a miracle that they're even surviving and that they're still open today.
They absolutely need this to stay in the green and get their employees paid. This would boost our local economy by helping them with the first and most important expense any business has, and that is their employees. This would help these struggling businesses by providing funds to help them with their rents, to purchase the buildings they are in, or by filling the empty holes or boarded up commercial spaces, which would boost our local economy by creating a business corridor destination. So that's why I'm here today. And thank you again, Chair Marquardt and Representative Abaje for inviting me to be here today.
Ms. Porter, thank you so much for your testimony. Next is KB Brown, and then Tabota Sayan is on deck.
Introduce yourself.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi, I'm KB Brown, owner of Wolfpack Promotionals and Alphawear Apparel. We are located on West Broadway. I know Crystal very well, and she covered most of what, you know, we have to say. I'm also a member of Main Street Alliance. This bill will actually help with a lot of the pitfalls that we have as business owners. I only hire from the community, and I typically hire kids during the summer. Last year, we had two students from North High. This year, we planned on having four. With a lot of the pitfalls, this bill will actually help us to be able to hire more people from the community and help them build their skills. North Minneapolis is a very resilient community, as most communities are, and they support their small businesses. This bill will actually help a lot. I don't need to say much more. I don't think if anyone has any questions, I'm more than willing to answer.
Mr. Brown, thank you so much for your testimony, taking the time today. Next is Tabota Sayan. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. I appreciate it. Hello, Crystal. Thank you for that testimony. I just want to say that I'm also a good friend of Crystal and a former resident of North Minneapolis, and I definitely second her response.
Would you please state your name before we go further for the record, please? We need that. So thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Sorry, I'm not following the rules.
Yeah, no, you're fine.
Okay, I've been told that before. My name is Tabota Sian, and I'm a member of the community. I currently own Infused Life Plant-Based Emporium in Minneapolis. What we do is we provide a holistic plant-based food products and services and prioritize creating communities for BIPOC-owned businesses and plant-based businesses within my storefront. I'm also a member of the Main Street Alliance, which is a network of small business owners working towards an equitable and resilient small business economy by creating resilient communities. This year, I was served with an eviction notice by my landlord for my commercial space within the first month of being late on my rent this past January. I was only late on rent once because I was shut down by my business. My business was shut down due to my whole entire family contacting COVID. I was refused the right to renew my lease this year without any explanation. I have started to look for different commercial spaces. In my search for new commercial space, I have encountered predatory landlords who have asked me to compromise my business plan to access capital from them or from other institutions so that they can create some leverage over me as I continue to identify opportunity to rent within their space. Now, to me, this is marginalization, especially as a Black woman who faces disparities in accessing capital and financial support. Receiving down payment assistance would provide me with the capital and the stability I need without relying on the goodwill of landlords, enabling me to build generational wealth through the ownership of my business property is what's really important for me at this time. And then also it does support all the women who are underneath the roof of my business because it provides them access to capital as well as they continue to grow their businesses. One of the provisions of the House File 4689 would provide down payment assistance to businesses seeking to purchase commercial property, which would be a tremendous amount of support to small businesses like mine by navigating countless challenges in the midst of COVID. Historically, as we know, small business owners support our communities by paying a livable wage to our employees, building relationships, boosting the local economy, and now we need your support in return. This bill will provide the financial support that I need to rent a new commercial space or to purchase a new commercial building space, in addition to being able to provide a safer space for the community, walkable spaces, and the ability to compete with the major corporations that are out here while continuing to cultivate community relationships through my business. So what I am doing is I'm urging you to pass House 4689 to demonstrate your support for all small business owners and entrepreneurs in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Sion, for that testimony. Thank you so much. Would anyone else like to testify on House File 4689 as amended? The revenue estimate doesn't include, of course, the $75 million in grants to counties. That's included in the bill. What you will see on the revenue estimate is the tax cut on the subtraction for, you know, all of the grants and that forgivable loans and so forth that went out to businesses from the state and the counties in the last couple of years is taxable. And so this takes away that tax. And so the cost is $20.9 million in 23 and then $900,000 in each of 24 and 25. So members, any questions for the author or any of the testifiers? Seeing none, Representative Egbaje, House File 4689 is amended. Closing thoughts.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say thank you to my testifiers. Thank you for being vulnerable and sharing your stories. We know that small businesses, particularly in my district, but also across the state, you know, I had the opportunity to travel with the Capital Investment Committee and have seen just how small businesses are working throughout Minnesota and keeping all of us on track. So I hope that we can earn the committee support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for bringing this forward. The chair will lay over House File 4689 as amended. Final bill on the agenda is House File 3588. Representative Vang, welcome to the Tax Committee. Thank you for being here. And before we go to you, we'll have someone move the bill. Who would like to move House File 3588?
So moved.
Representative Moran moves House File 3588. And there is an amendment. So Representative Moran, would you like to move the A5 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, so moved.
Representative Ram moves the A5 amendment. Representative Vang, is this the kind of put it in the order you want so that we could put that on there?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. So it's a more technical clarifications.
Very good. So with that, before we go to Representative Vang's discussion of the bill, let's put this amendment on. I'm going to call for the vote on the A5 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, say nay. The motion does prevail. The A5 amendment is adopted. Representative Vang, to your bill, House File 3588, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I know I'm the only person stopping you all from grabbing your lunch, so I will make this quick. House File 3588 is meant to be another tool in the toolbox to address how we can build more affordable housing. It does not require any state funding. This program is completely like a tool, an option for the city to use or not on a project by project basis. It has a term of 10 to 20 years. It is not debt like tax increment financing and therefore will not impact the city statutory debt limits. The program reduces the market rate assessed value for a newly constructed building by 50% and the corresponding 50% reduction in real estate taxes, offset the difference in rents between market rate and 60% area median income. It requires annual compliance certification by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and it will significantly broaden the number of developers and investors' interests to be willing to develop and invest in affordable housing, and thus greatly increase the number of affordable housing units built. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will defer to my testifier.
Very good. Thank you so much, Representative Bang. The revenue estimate for House File 3588 here is for 2025. It's an unknown, is how they have that. So with that, Kelly Duran, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kelly Dorn, and I'm the founder and owner of Dorn Properties Group, a commercial real estate development that specializes in the construction of market rate multifamily housing. For over 10 years, affordable housing has been a lead issue in many communities across the state. Unfortunately, the demand continues to outpace the supply. And some of that is because of the tools that are currently available for developers and communities to use to offset the differences between the revenue streams created by market rate rents versus affordable rents. If you ask anybody in the nonprofit or profit sector, it's not uncommon for there to be 8 to 10 different sources of capital needed in order to put into a project, affordable project, to get something under construction today. Those tools are important, viable, but they're just simply not enough. We've created this tool to exempt a portion of the tax valuation aspect, in a lot of cases to use in lieu of TIF. TIF, as you all probably know, tax increment financing, basically predominantly is used as a pay-as-you-go note issued to a developer. It takes literally 100% of the increase in the tax revenue and used to pay that note, which also includes interest payments. In this particular vehicle, there is no interest calculated. It simply reduces the value of the property that has an affordable component by 50%, and that offset in taxes will also then go to offset the difference in rents. There has been some issues raised about whether this will create a tax shift. It is my personal view, and I think the language of the bill provides for that, that it really doesn't take create a tax shift, because the assessed value is never fully assessed. And so there is no increase in value or reduction in value that creates a tax problem that shifts the taxes. And so I don't believe that there is a tax shift on this. We've vetted that a little bit, probably needs a little bit more, but I don't think it creates that. It's also not a substitute for 4D. And in fact, this bill particularly says that this product cannot be used with 4D. 4D by itself is typically not enough of a tool to finance the construction of a new building with affordable housing within it. Typically, 4D is used in conjunction with other tools in order to bridge the gap necessary to construct these buildings. 4D is not uncommonly used with TIF or other types of vehicles to make that package work, and one of the many solutions. This product will by itself create the resources to be able to build buildings, not just in the urban core, but across the state, to meet the growing demand for affordable housing at 60% AMI. It is not meant to be a cure-all for every situation in the affordable housing financing aspect. It is meant to be an additional tool. One of those aspects, the positive aspects, is only about 15% of the development community today participates in the construction of affordable housing. And one of the reasons for that is it's just too complicated. It's too complicated and it's too costly. This product is simple. It's simple to understand. It's easy for a city to understand. It's predictable. The development community can understand it. Investors can understand it, and additional lenders that will bring capital into this market. So this will expand the financing base in the private sector to bring new capital into creating more additional housing that we are falling behind on. And lastly, as I said earlier, there is no interest on this. So unlike TIF, it does not create interest that multiplies the cost of the subsidy over the period of its duration. This is totally elective at the municipal level, They can choose to use it or not use it as their as they deem appropriately. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions anybody has. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Doran. Appreciate that very much. Is there anyone else that would like to testify before we move to members on House File 3588 as amended? If not, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I do have a concern here, maybe more of a question, because I've been dealing with the property tax market value exclusions with the disabled veterans for several years now, where we do some exclusion on property taxes for those veterans that are 70% to 100% disabled. And those taxes are shifted. I mean, the counties, they have to collect the tax from somebody, so they shift the tax to other homeowners. And most homeowners that I know, they have no problem when it comes to our disabled veterans. So the testifiers here said that there was not going to be a shift, if I understood that right. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Doran had mentioned in his opinion he did not think there was.
Okay.
So that's.
Well, I think maybe the county should, Mr. Chair. I think maybe the county should, if there's somebody from the county, sir, they should address this issue, because I really believe that when you're talking about a property tax market exclusion, that's going to be shifted to other taxpayers in the county. That's my understanding. And I've been working with that for many years with disabled veterans.
So let me do, I'll go to Mr. Doran. He can, you know, explain that again. But if there is someone here from the counties, I don't know if there's anyone on site here or not. They certainly could give their viewpoint. But Mr. Doran, did you want to cover why you thought there was not? And then I see Mr. Mossman is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer. One other side note, in the Senate version of this bill, which was heard in the Property Tax Committee and the Senate side on Wednesday, it was offered that there, in the Senate version, that there would be an amendment made that would require county approval for this type of product to be used. And my understanding is that would be provided in an amendment that Senator Bach would be providing during the conference committee as part of this, if the bill makes it to that point. And I don't oppose that. I think counties are, it's perfectly acceptable for counties to have a voice in this process. Our belief in why it doesn't create a tax shift is, and I don't know the particular instances of your situations with the veterans housing, Representative Detmer, so I apologize for that. But the basis of this is that If a building is built and it's valued by the assessor at $50 million to pick a number, and they simply cut that value in half, and then the building is assessed at 25, because that building was never certified as a $50 million value, the building is assessed at 25 and certified at 25. It doesn't create that difference that then becomes subject to the tax shift. That's my understanding of it. I mean, and I'm not going to proclaim to be an expert at this, but that's my understanding of it, and as to how it would actually work.
Thank you. So I'm going to go to Mr. Mossman, and you don't have to, I guess, stick just to this issue if you want, but while you're on, if you want to comment on House File 3588 as amended.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, Matt Mossman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association, thank you. I'll just want to start by saying housing is very important to us in counties. So, you know, we're always open to conversations about useful tools. We do see this as a shift in taxes. Generally speaking, the property tax, an ad valorem tax, begins with the premise of valuing everybody's asset, in this case, the asset being property, adding up everybody's shared assets, and then distributing the property tax levy across those assets. So whenever there are exceptions, in this case, an exclusion that would only put half of that asset value into the denominator of the calculation, in effect, it does give a tax benefit to those property owners that in effect is picked up by other property owners. So we do see it as a shift.
Okay, thank you. So we do have two views on this, so we won't go into the shift anymore. But Representative Detmer, do you have any other questions?
Well, it's, Mr. Chair, it's just that I, you know, I've been working with the veterans communities for years now, and I know that when you have a property tax exclusion, it is picked up by other taxpayers in the county. Thank you, Mr.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, can I just add something to Mr.
Doran? You bet.
Yes. We can have a difference of opinion as to whether it's technically a shift or not, and that's fine. But in the advent that it is a shift, if this tool is effectively, for the most part, going to replace TIF, and if a city elects to build this type of building and uses TIF instead, that is also a shift. Under a TIF scenario, it's 100% shift because there is no revenue being generated. All of the revenue in the increase in value of the property goes to pay the debt instrument, typically a pay-as-you-go note that's issued to the developer. In this instance, only 50% of the taxes would go towards this revenue offset and not a principal reduction in the cost of the project. And the other 50% continues to flow to the other taxing jurisdictions, cities, school districts, and counties. So on a present value basis, this is a much less of a shift, if you want to argue that it's a shift, over the life of the elected duration, which is between 10 and 20 years. And typically a TIF district would be, with interest included, it's not uncommon for a TIF district to be 15 to 20 years.
Representative Detmer, anything further?
Well, one thing that I've talked with Minnesota's Association of Municipal Counties over the years is they've been asking to possibly, instead of going with a property tax market value exclusion, is go with a tax credit towards maybe those properties to offset what they're trying to do. So that's something that I've been approached about. But again, I support what we're doing for our veterans population, the disabled veterans, and I understand what a property tax market exclusion is, and it is shifting taxes to other communities, taxpayers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Thank you. Representative Gomez.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Detmer is absolutely right. A market value exclusion is a shift. It takes some serious mental gymnastics to think of it, I believe, in any other way. Whether it's, you know, whether it's a shift that's going to take place in the future, or it's a shift based on, you know, what we're looking at today. And I know this doesn't go backwards. This only goes forwards. But it's more than a difference of opinion. It's I believe a misinterpretation. I'll just start there. So I have some serious issues with this bill. Let me just start with, you know, the fact that this is more generous than 4D, which is the mechanism that this sort of aligns with somewhat. It absolutely is a shift onto other property taxpayers. That is how property tax levies work. If we don't assess if we allow a market value exclusion, then the money that would be paid by these projects will go on to other property categories. That's undeniable. I guess, you know, my understanding, right, is that this, just to back up, like, purportedly this is designed to increase the supply of affordable housing. And when we have a policy intent like that, which of course I very much agree with, you know, I chair the Preventing Homelessness Division, I serve on the Housing Committee, I'm the Vice Chair of the Property Tax Committee, and I serve on this committee. So the intersection of housing and taxes is actually kind of like my top legislative priority, my top legislative concern, the thing that I've learned the most about since I've been here. And when you say, okay, that's our intent, what we have to do is we have to evaluate whether this is the best tool to achieve that intent. Is this the right tool to produce more affordable housing, or is there another way? Because all of these proposals have costs, whether they're direct general fund costs, cost to our bottom line, or they come in the form of cost to other property tax or other property categories, as in this case. So there's no guarantee that you know, we heard that this offset in taxes is going to create an offset in rent. There is no actual mechanism for that in this bill. There's no guarantee that this money would be reinvested in the property even. There's, you know, when you allow a for-profit entity to take a tax benefit like this, it's a giveaway to a for-profit entity, and we're not telling them what to do with that money. It could go to salaries for executives. It could go to shareholders. There's no guarantee on this that this giveaway would end up in the pockets of low-income renters or, you know, in maintaining the buildings that they're living in. Allowing a 50% market value exclusion for a project where only 20% of the units are affordable is out of whack. That's not how our other mechanisms like 4D that we have to, you know, support affordable housing work. Setting the affordability level at 60% of area median income does not help us to meet our most critical affordable housing needs, which, as Mr. Doran, even though he's on the for-profit side and doesn't do a lot of affordable, he says, I'm sure knows that 30% and lower is that deeply affordable housing is our greatest need. And so if we're designing policy solutions to the affordable housing crisis, and we're not targeting our public investments and public tools at that deeply affordable level, then we're missing the mark. Let's see. So the other thing that I want to just talk about, you know, this doesn't make our tax code more simple. This makes our tax code a little more complex. And whenever we are adding complexity to our tax code, which this does, we have to evaluate whether the policy is going to be really good at achieving its desired goal. And so I believe that analysis is lacking on this particular effort. 4D is not designed to offset the entire cost of an affordable housing development because, like, our cities and counties can't afford that. Our property taxpayers can't afford that. I know that financing affordable housing is like so complex and, you know, it's unfortunate and we need to do things to simplify it and align resources, but adding complexity with a sort of uncertain outcome to our property tax code is not the way to do it. Finally, you know, I just want to say that, like I said, I'm on the vice chair of the property tax committee. This is very clearly a property tax issue. Our committee has undertaken, you know, with leadership from Chair Joachim and Representative Herr, a comprehensive, and I want to mention that Representative Howard has been working on an effort to allow nonprofit developers to apply for 4D. And we're hesitant to do it because we're worried about the shift. So the idea of expanding this even more to for-profit developers really has to give us pause. And again, the 50% market value exclusion for 20% of units is really a diversion from the way that we've treated any of this property. And so this should have come to property taxes. We have undertaken a careful and thoughtful and rigorous process in our property tax division about how it is that we can use our property tax policy to support the development of affordable housing. You know, we did a whole study on it instead of implementing a policy that we didn't really understand the implications of for our cities and counties and other tax types. And so, you know, I guess, I mean, again, the chair will tell you, I think the first conversation that he and I had one-to-one was about, Mr. Chair, I want to figure out how it is that we can help, that we can use the tax code to help us build more housing, to help us meet this critical need in our communities, because every community in Minnesota is struggling with this issue. And so I've worked on that, and our property tax committee is working on that. And to me, this effort, I work in these areas. Nobody's contacted me telling me that this is going to help them build a more affordable housing. Nobody's contacted me asking for this. We haven't discussed it in a housing committee. We haven't discussed it in property taxes. I wish we were voting on this bill, because I would like to vote it down, because it's really, There are a lot of policy issues and it's not ready and it has not been vetted by the people in this body who have been thinking about these issues for many years. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Gomez, for your comments. You're spot on nearly everything that you've said. Over this last 10 years in the Property Tax Committee, it clearly does create a shift. I guess you could maybe get into the nuances as presented by the testifier and making a comparison to TIF. I guess you could say you've got the but-for test. If it were not but for this 50% exclusion, the building wouldn't exist, so therefore there'd be no property taxes on it anyway. However, to Representative Gomez's point, you know, there's many complexities of trying to provide affordable housing, and it's not clear whether or not repurposed buildings could use this exclusion to create affordable housing, which means clearly then there would be a shift. There are guidelines or principles in real estate development, highest and best use, for example. And what an exclusion like this would do would encourage developers with this exclusion to buy land within the areas that can produce the highest rents. I mean, think about what that does. The three rules of real estate are location, location, location. And so you go ahead and buy some of the most expensive land to put affordable housing on, doesn't do a service to the rest of the taxpayers and the other 55 classes of property to be shifting tax burden to others. I think it's also important to think about innovations like this in terms of considering them. Over the last 10 years, I've noticed there's a number of for-profit, not-for-profit housing entities that have come in and they're getting all sorts of special incentives to create housing. And what's interesting about a lot of these proposals is they're only obligated to maintain these as affordable housing for a certain period of time. So imagine taking a $50 million building, as maybe the example was cited, and you have half of the carrying cost over 10 or 15 years by reducing the property taxes. Over that same 10 or 15 years, the property is appreciating in value. You also get other incentives that are often commonly given, like waiving of WAC and SAC charges and other discounts or property or sales tax exemptions, other types of things like this. But in the end, you've greatly lowered the basis for the for-profit and even nonprofit development community. And once they've met their obligation to provide this for a period of time, now you can liquidate the property in the full marketplace at its fair market value. And your basis was lowered at the time of construction, and now you've got a great capital gain. You can flip it in a 1031 exchange and move on to the next property. It's a heck of a nice business plan. And nice enough that I've even thought about maybe doing it myself. And I don't see the true incentive of this. Lastly, affordable housing is an issue. And I have oftentimes talked about the other things that we need to do to make housing more affordable. And I've mentioned that government is part of the problem in terms of making it more expensive. In this particular instance, I'm also very concerned about the interactions between some of the other programs that where we've done targeted relief. Now imagine property that is only being taxed at 50% of its value, and then all of the occupants in here are entitled to the renter's credit. The renter's credit doesn't make allowance for properties like this. So you'd have less property taxes being collected. We'd end up paying out more in renter's credit than is actually being paid on the building. So there are some interactions here that we need to be careful about and consider with regard to these types of proposals. So, Mr. Chair, this is a novel idea. It's maybe innovative, but I think it needs a lot more work, and I would concur with Representative Gomez. I couldn't support this at this time, and it needs a whole lot more work. And I'll end my comments there. We're getting close to the end of the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Chair Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank all the folks that have spoken so far, because I think there is a lot of concern around this. And I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to vet it more in property taxes. We just simply ran out of time. I know you've heard some of my concerns in our discussions, Mr. Doran, and also in the local government division, because this does create a new tool for local government. And I know the author, Representative Vang, and I have also chatted too, and I think we all share a lot of concerns about the desperate need for affordable housing around our state, and wanting to make sure how we invest in that gives us the best bang for our buck as well. And I know you relay this, you know, compared to TIF, which in a sense it is, that the cities are the only ones that have to okay this project. My concern is that with TIF, when we capture the excess, we capture the new amount that's going to be increased on the value of the property. So you set a base, and then the TIF is on the added value that the project brings. And I'm not quite sure this would do that, because you're doing it on the whole entire property. I know it's been compared to 4D too, which I've learned a lot more about 4D in the last few years as we've been doing work on it with the proponents of making some changes to that, because we all know it can't just be the nonprofit sector that builds. We can't keep up. We need to also have the for-profit sector in there. And as Representative Gomez said, we desperately need to figure out a better way and an easier way to help our help build affordable housing. And I think we all agree on that as well. But with this proposal, what's unlike 4D is that it's giving you a tax treatment on the entire property and not just the units that are affordable. So there's a concern there. I know we did some work around 4D last year with the help of Representative Herr. We froze the first tier at that $100,000, kind of we rolled it back to that and took off the inflator for a while so that more people could reach that second tier of the 0.25 classification. But we still have some work to do around that as well. And that might be focusing our energy on that might be a better way to go. But, you know, I have to say, it's always nice to have more tools in the toolbox. And I think if we keep working on this and looking at it, we might find a way to make it a little bit better. It's actually very similar to a tool we already have with abatement. And with abatement, cities are allowed to do a lot of these exemptions for value, either in property tax or subsidies, but they have to bring the county and the school district along, which I think you're hearing some concerns for the fact that the counties wouldn't be able to have a say in this, nor the school districts, because, you know, it does create a shift. I understand you're saying, but for this, it wouldn't be built, but something will be built there. And I only had one other, and I do appreciate everything. Like I said, Representative Detmer, Vice Chair Gomez, Representative Hertas said, the only thing I would say is, I do also want to be careful that we aren't looking at high value property and saying we can't build affordable housing there, because a lot of our high value property is high value because it's near highways or it's near transit. And we have a lot of folks that need affordable housing, that need access to transit and maybe transit dependent. So we always struggle with that. I'm a city that's looking at, you know, having a fixed line built in, and we've been watching properties for a long time. I know Mr. Doran, thank you. You built one of your properties in our city because the light rail was there. So having that balance to make sure we're not freezing out the people that desperately need the transit too. So there's some work to be done on this. I do share concerns. I wish we would have had a chance to have it in property taxes, but we just ran out of time. And I just wanted to continue to work with Representative Vang on this. And thank you folks for letting me babble on.
Thank you very much, Chair Joaquim. So, Mr. Doran, there weren't any questions in the last three testifiers, but usually I allow the testifier to respond to questions, but a lot of the comments certainly was. So before I go to Representative Vang for closing comments, Mr. Doran, any comments on or thoughts here then from what you've heard?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I appreciate the comments in the debate. I think that's all fair. I think there's, as I think all of the representatives said, affordable housing is very complicated, and financing it is even more complicated. And I think that's really why I'm here. I've been building things in this community for 40 years. In 2000, the Met Council projected for the period between 2011 and 2020 that the metropolitan area needed 45,000 new affordable housing units. Only 16,500 of those were actually built. In addition, approximately 4,000 affordable housing units went to market rate each year during that time. So we actually went backwards on the creation of affordable housing. I don't even build affordable housing. I may not even use this bill. I'm getting too old to probably play in this game much longer. I think there's a couple things that I would like to just offer up. This is actually very simple. This is not complicated. The reason that we're not doing it is because the existing tools that are in place are complicated and are too complicated. And that's why only a small fraction of the development community chooses to participate in the construction of affordable housing. This bill is very simple. It simply just takes the value that the city assessor establishes every year and reduces it by 50%. And those tax savings have a revenue neutral basis to the difference in the rents for the property owner between the affordable aspect and the tax savings. So it's not a windfall. And unlike TIF, TIF is actually a windfall. TIF actually does reduce the basis of the property and creates that windfall when the property is sold. And if this property under this program decides or is at the end of its period, it simply turns off the reduction in assessed value and the property goes to full assessed value at that time. So there is a delay in the tax generation here. And we could probably all agree on that. But anyway, those are some comments. I just want to pass along my thoughts on that. I've been doing this a long time, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. And hopefully we'll have a chance to correct some of these deficiencies that are noted here if the people are concerned about them as we move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Doran. Appreciate that. Representative Bang, final comments on House File 3588 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to express my thanks to you and the committee for hearing this bill. I hear all of your concerns very clearly, and that's really the purpose of the committee process, is to have these types of discussion and how we can continue to improve this bill. So Mr. Doran and I will continue to work with all of you to make sure that this is the best bill possible for the state of Minnesota. I'll just leave it at that. I look forward to everyone's support.
Thank you very much, Representative Bang. The chair will lay over House File 3588 as amended. Members, thank you, thank you, thank you. We got through 9 bills in the proper period of time. Monday by noon, the House Omnibus Tax Bill will be hopefully posted by then. And so next Tuesday, we will go over the bill. Next Wednesday, we will have testimony, and next Thursday we will mark up the bill. And by 1 p.m., I guess it is on 1 p.m., I guess, by Monday is the time. So members, have a great weekend. Thanks again for your work today and this week, and we are adjourned.